This episode is brought to you by Chai Pani Restaurant Group.
This week on Meat in 3, we're looking at factors that will shape our food world in 2019. We start with trend predictions and how media covers them.
A website could theoretically devote all their coverage to these viral trends and get all sorts of hits. That's not a way to build sustainable readerships, just as it's not a way to build, you know, sustainable restaurants.
We report on a big change coming and how street meat will be served.
On January 1st, a ban on plastic foam went into effect in New York City.
And we round out the episode with a story about using gene editing to create the spicy tomato of the future.
At first, it sounds like a gimmick or like something that you would do for fun. The truth is, there is a real value behind it.
It's not too late to make your resolution. Subscribe to Meat in 3 wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single episode this year.
Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Today, my guest is Kimbal Musk, the co-founder and executive chairman of three companies that approach food and agriculture from different angles. Square Roots, a vertical farming company that grows food hydroponically in shipping containers, The Kitchen Restaurant Group, and Big Green, a nonprofit that builds learning gardens in classrooms. Kimbal, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from snowy Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, great. So that's where the original kitchen restaurant is. Do you spend most of your time in Boulder?
I do, yeah. It's my favorite part of America. I come from South Africa. I'm an immigrant. And I have tried California, I've tried New York, I've driven around the country as far as I could find, and I've settled on Boulder. I've been here about 16 years.
Yeah, I've been to Colorado many times, never to Boulder, though, and I hear the food there is pretty amazing. There's a lot going on, right?
It really is. I mean, when I found Boulder, it's on the surface is a 100,000-person town. It has the same amount of restaurants per capita as New York City.
Oh, my gosh.
It's incredible.
Wow, that's crazy. So as I mentioned, you've got, in addition to the Kitchen Restaurant Group, you've got a lot of different businesses in food and agriculture. A good place to start, I think, is when you talk about what you do, you use the phrase real food a lot. So what do you mean by that?
Real food is quite simply food that you trust to nourish your body, that you trust to nourish the farmer, and you trust to nourish the planet. It is really the key word there is trust. And in the industrial food supply chain, we've lost trust in our system. Mm. Food is really designed to be shipped. 80% of our organic produce is shipped in from around the world. It's from places as far away as China. It is just not truly food that you trust. Compared to understanding our supply chain and creating a new supply chain, working with American farmers, farmers that you do know that you can actually connect with if you wanted to. I mean, obviously, as a consumer, you may not do that, but you can trust a restaurant to do that, or you can trust a grocery store to do that. And we have incredible farmers locally. So for me, from my perspective, I love local as a powerful proxy for trust. Mm. Organic is also a decent proxy, but I don't like shipping things from around the world. I think it's not good for the planet. It certainly doesn't help our local farmers. And I think there's a little bit of concern around trust when you don't know the country that it's coming from. And so I think that critically the most important thing about real food is just that sort of gut feeling that you trust the food you're eating.
Right. That's really interesting when you think about it in the context of local food systems, thinking about that relationship and the trust as kind of a basis for all of the other kind of benefits that are talked about. I mean, do you see that? Do you see local food systems as sort of as a better way to kind of change food, as opposed to like what you said, organic or other kind of solutions that are more global. Do you think local is really sort of the best way to go?
Well, I think that local is a term that has been that could be used in many ways. So for our restaurants, for example, we really think about American farmers as farmers that we can connect with and you know, meet with regularly. These farmers may be a few hundred miles away, or they may even be in another state, but to us, they are farmers that we know. So this concept of know your farmer obviously is a lot easier if they are local.
Mm.
But if you want to get salad greens in January, you're going to have to go, unless you work with urban farming companies like Square Roots,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have to go to California or to farmers in a climate that can grow greens. And that's okay. So I think that local is a term that is powerful, but it's really the critical element is knowing your farmer.
Right, right. So you mentioned Square Roots. Let's talk about that. I mean, this is sort of this huge business that you started, and you know, this is the Farm Report, so obviously I want to talk about farming. And
right.
I actually got to go on a tour of the farm last week here in Brooklyn.
What did you think?
It was so interesting. And you know, the craziest thing was it was this rainy night in New York, and I mean, it was kind of pouring, to be honest. And there were 75 people there that showed up to stand in the rain and see this shipping container farm. And that just kind of blew me away that there was so much interest in what
it was at night as well, right?
Yeah, at night too. So like in the dark, in the rain. and I mean, the one thing that was really cool is the visual, you know, when you're standing in the dark and Tobias, your co-founder, kind of slid open the door of one of the containers, and then you see this kind of glow coming from inside from the lights. It's a really arresting kind of visual. So I guess, you know, I got to see it up close, but most people don't. So can you sort of give listeners a sense of what the growing system looks like? Like what's the technology that you're using to grow food?
Sure. Well, Square Roots was sort of born out of this goal of knowing your farmer, trusting your food, bringing it to everywhere in America, you know, even in January, to be able to give the freshest, most delicious greens to Brooklyn when it's grown in Brooklyn. I mean, that really is powerful. And we also wanted to include the farmer in this. We wanted this to be about creating a next generation of farmers. So we came across this approach to growing in shipping containers, and shipping containers are standard in size, but what we do inside them has been advancing quite considerably. So when we first started, we took a shipping container. We had these sort of racks that were in there, and we would use a lighting system that was sort of off the shelf kind of lighting system. And we would generate, with one farmer, you could generate maybe 25 to 30 pounds a week in produce,
okay,
which is about half an acre of outdoor growing if you factor in, you know, the number of seasons. So it's quite a lot of space,
right,
relative to, you know, one shipping container. But what we've done over the past 2 years is really started to advance the technology. And now, like the technology you saw a few weeks ago, is we use full spectrum lighting with a few of the frequencies. Was it the frequency? A few of the light bands removed that really focus on growing the leaf of the green. So, for example, basil, we remove far red from the spectrum. Far red is a color or a light spectrum that exists when a forest grows over. So, in the winter time, there are no leaves on the trees, and so you get full spectrum light that hits the ground. And what that does is it gives maximum light to the ground while there are no trees no leaves on the trees.
Right.
But as springtime comes and the leaves start to fall over, it creates shadow. And it's still light underneath the tree, but it's a shadow light. And that shadow light causes the stalk to grow, and it causes the basil to stretch for sunlight.
Mm.
And you actually don't need that indoors. And so we've removed far red from the spectrum. And what that does is it focuses all the light on the leaf of the basil. And as a result, we're now approaching 100 pounds a week per container, which is almost 3 acres of outdoor growing space, equivalent of outdoor growing space.
Right.
So it really has been an extraordinary path to, you know, grow delicious, real food in a local community, and doing it with a farmer. So a farmer will take over one container, manage one container, and as we continue to expand our productivity, that farmer actually still does the same amount of work, but their productivity goes from 30 to 50 to 100 pounds a week.
Right. What is the farmer actually doing in this scenario? Like, what is their role?
So the farmer, they're doing all the typical things a farmer would do. They're, you know, growing from seedlings, then they transfer the seedlings into the towers. They manage the nutrients. They manage the climate. They do the harvesting. They'll do the packaging. And then they'll often even deliver it to the grocery store.
Hmm. And I mean,
so the technology is the platform. So the farmer still has to do the work.
Right. Well, and I mean, I ask because, you know, with a lot of these sort of technology advanced sort of systems for growing, there's been a lot of coverage lately of farms that are more automated. And I just saw yesterday that there's like on AgFunder that there's going to be like the first fully automated farm. I think I'm pretty sure it was an indoor one. And so I'm curious, in your system, is the farmer you sort of keep mentioning the farmer as a really important element. Does that feel like that will always be part of it? Or is there a sense of like automation is on the horizon?
You know, we're huge fans of automation where it makes sense,
mm-hmm.
but the way we would automate would be to empower a farmer to be more effective and more efficient and more productive. We don't look at the automation as a critical step. I mean, what we manage very, very carefully is energy use.
Okay.
So energy use and energy cost is a very, very high cost. But automation has not sort of we just haven't seen it driving the kind of benefit that we would hope to achieve with automation. And I think the other thing is if you take the automation out, you kind of lose the soul of the food.
Mm.
It's not particularly interesting either. So that's not to say we won't do it at some point, or we won't get involved, and we won't find a way to use it. It's just not in our core thinking.
Right, right. And you're also doing like a lot of training programs for farmers, correct?
Right.
Yeah, and are those if a farmer goes through Square Ridge training program, are those skills transferable to other growing systems, or are they pretty particular to the system that you use?
I mean, they're definitely transferable. I think that you're gonna if you wanted to grow outdoors on soil, you would have to take a year to kind of get used to that environment. But you would have an extraordinary understanding of farming.
Mm.
In fact, the USDA provides a loan to any of the graduates of the Square Roots program. I believe the number is $350,000 if they do want to start a farm, whether it's soil or indoors. The USDA believes that what we're doing, what skills we're teaching them, enable them to qualify for that loan.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, that's a huge benefit. Young farmers need a lot of help getting started. Yeah. And so you mentioned just now that the energy use is a high cost though that you're trying to manage. And I know, so you know, it's like you're producing so much more food in this small space. And I know your system also uses a lot less water than other growing systems like outdoor farming. But the energy use is huge. How does that factor into whether or not this is a sustainable way to farm, and how do you manage that?
Sure. So the energy use can come in multiple forms. So that's one way to look at it.
Mm.
And the other one is getting more efficient with the energy.
Right.
So on the first part, if we locate where there are where there is excess energy, so for example, around hydroelectric areas. So if we in Seattle, that would be pretty straightforward to do that. The other thing that happens with electricity is there's certain times of the day when we have excess electricity. So if you talk to an energy plant, they actually run the plant constantly all the time. And so if you actually use electricity from 9 p.m. until 7 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
you you're using electricity that is just being sent into the ground. It is electricity that the electricity plants cannot give it away. Huh. And so as we grow, the likely path is more along the lines of using energy when it is basically free and available.
Okay.
And so we wouldn't actually use much energy at all from the grid because we can adjust our growing cycle to be any time of the day. So if we want the growing cycle to, if we want daytime to be from 9 p.m. till 7 a.m., that's pretty easy.
Huh.
Because it is a closed environment.
Right.
So there are quite a few ways to find ways to use energy in super efficient ways. To use energy that's already out there. And then on the efficiency side, you have lighting systems that are just constantly being updated and upgraded. So to the energy use we have today can generate 100 pounds of basil in a week. 2 years ago, we could generate 25 pounds of basil with the same amount of energy.
So it's just getting better and better.
It's just getting better and better.
Yeah.
And I think, of course, you also have solar energy sources, you have wind energy sources. So it's about being very smart with the energy we use and understanding that we actually have a lot of energy in our system that isn't being used and that can be leveraged really well for indoor farming.
Right, right. And another thing that was interesting to me is at Square Roots in Brooklyn, right now you're only growing herbs. Is that sort of a first step as well in terms of like you'll eventually grow more crops or I'm curious why you chose herbs specifically?
Sure. So the technology platform we built is really defined for premium products. So if we were to do romaine lettuce, which as you can imagine has a lot of demand right now for indoor farming,
right.
It's still not a premium product. And so the farmers wouldn't get much for their work. They would still produce 100 pounds of romaine, but it wouldn't be it wouldn't be the same dollar value as basil. So it's really about making sure we get the credit for producing the premium product that we're growing, and that's where it really works in the herb space. That the next steps will be expanding into other lines as we sort of figure out what is the best way to expand, and but it will come from a premium perspective. Over time, our goal is to be able to serve at every price point and at every and to be in every geography.
So what will need to change to make it a system that can grow things that are not that premium food?
We're still doing work on that. Exactly.
Okay.
We're still doing work on that. I mean, we'll always be premium, so it'll be a premium version of romaine. But the truth is you can't charge the same price for basil, for romaine as you can for basil.
Mm.
So what we'll do is we'll have most likely a different form factor for the farm. It'll be a farm very much specifically designed for romaine or very much specifically designed for arugula.
Mm.
It would not be we wouldn't use the same platform.
Okay. I mean, that's interesting. I hadn't, because I'm sort of thinking about, you know, I know when you talk about Square Roots a lot, it's about sort of providing local food. And it's, you know, I think there's like sort of, it's interesting that one of the goals is to make sure that the farmers are paid well, right? This premium is allowing the price to stay at a level that everyone is being paid a fair wage. But then at the same time, it's like the food that's really going to provide calories and nutrients is not, you know, a basil, right? It's a romaine. Like, that's kind of a funny.
I think that at the right time that we will get there.
Mm-hmm.
We just don't believe that the technology is really well designed for that.
Okay.
It's not to say that it won't. We're constantly doing R&D around it. We believe the technology is really best suited right now for herbs, and at the right time we will expand it to romaine. But when we do that, we'll create an environment that says, okay, or a technology platform that says, this is really what the farmer has to make. What is the amount of basil they need to grow? What is the climate that the basil should grow in that is really a perfect climate for romaine?
Mm-hmm.
What we did with basil was pretty amazing. There's an incredible season of basil in 2009 from Genoa in Italy. And we mapped, or one of our farmers mapped the weather system. What time the sun comes up, what time is the sunset, what's the humidity, what's the oxygen, what's the carbon dioxide levels, what days did it rain?
Mm.
And he replicated that season indoors And that's really what's become the premium basil in New York, is the square roots basil is the number one basil in New York, and it's because of that approach.
The climate is identical to Italy
in a
shipping container in Brooklyn.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's
no, it's not just the weather,
wild.
But the content of the air. It is amazing.
Wow.
And so we can totally control the climate. And so we would do something similar with romaine. We would say, okay, let's go look around for the world's best romaine, talk to chefs around the world that can say, you know, we really love this, really understand what the consumer wants, and then work to figure out a weather system and a climate that, and of course lighting as well, what they call a light recipe, which is a combination of the lighting as well as the climate. And what is the perfect light recipe for romaine? And then make sure we can grow enough so a farmer can make a living.
Right.
And that's how we would build it.
Got it. I want to, so we're going to need to take a break, but I think this is a perfect place to stop, because when we come back, I want to talk more about, use the romaine example as a segue into talking about another initiative you have going, which is a transparency timeline. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Chai Pani Restaurant Group. From Bombay to Buncombe and Asheville to Atlanta, Chai Pani has extended the love of food, culinary experience, and storytelling to the Southeast. Founded by Meherwani and Molly Irani, Chai Pani Restaurant Group includes two locations of Chai Pani, plus MG Road Bar and Lounge, Botiwala, Buxton Hall Barbecue, and their new spice company, Spicewala. Learn more about Chai Pani and watch their documentary series, Cutting Chai, at chaipanirestaurantgroup.com. That's Chaipani restaurantgroup.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has lots more. My name is Carrie Diamond, and I'm the host of Radio Cherry Bomb here on HRN. The show features interviews with the coolest, most creative women in and around the world of food. We've spoken to icons like Ina Garten, Christina Tosi, and Padma Lakshmi, and brought you new voices like Michelle Johnson of The Chocolate Barista and Lisa Ludwinski of Sister Pie. You can find Radio Cherry Bomb wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I've been talking to Kimball Musk, the co-founder of Square Roots, the Kitchen Restaurant Group, and Big Green. And so before the break, we were really talking about basil, right? But then it sort of segued into this kind of conversation about romaine, and which made me think about the fact that lately we've been all sort of hearing about these food contamination issues that seem to be popping up a lot more frequently lately. And, you know, one of the things with like the romaine scare was that a lot of these issues are hard to contain because the supply chain is long and complicated and we don't know where they originate. Square Roots launched something called the transparency timeline. So can you tell me how that works?
Yeah, no, it was pretty powerful. We have this incredible ability to track everything that is done with our food, from the seedling to harvest to packaging, who is involved. And it was quite shocking to us when the romaine scare happened. And it took them, I think it was up to 6 weeks to find out which farm it came from, which is just extraordinary.
Yeah.
In that process, we also learned it changes hands several times, and the number of days it takes to get romaine from the time it's harvested to the shelf of a grocery store, not even to your home, but to the shelf of a grocery store, is 11 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about the food waste that can be saved when, if you can harvest food the day it's ready, put it on the grocery store shelf, you have another 11 days before it might go bad. So if you take romaine from a grocery store today, you will have maybe 2 days to use it, but it actually sat for another 11 days. So you have almost 2 weeks to use it if you could get it fresh. anyway, we learned all these things, and we just thought it was really powerful to share our transparency approach and our timeline. This was an internal timeline that we decided to share publicly, because we want to make sure and totally understand what's going on with the food we're growing. And so we decided to share this with the consumers. So if you walk up to a container of basil or chives or mint at a grocery store in Brooklyn with a Square Roots name on it, you just put your phone up to it. It'll scan the QR code, and it will take you through every single day of that herb's life, of the basil's life, from this morning when it arrived at the grocery store to earlier this morning where it was harvested, all the way back to, you know, a month or two ago when the seedlings were seeded, and who was part of that process. And that transparency timeline has just been so well received by consumers to learn and understand more about their food, to trust their food more, coming back to the powerful role that trust plays in this whole process.
Right. Well, and it's, you know, I did get to see it, and it's pretty crazy. You can see like each little step, but it's kind of funny too, because in your case, the supply chain is really pretty short, and you know where things are coming from. And so, you know, the consumer's able to see it. And then in this case, it's like, in a weird way, it's not so much needed, because you're like, oh yeah, it just came from that shipping container in Brooklyn.
Right.
So, exactly. Yeah. So
I think though, as we sort of grow our production, and someone gets their food in, I'm trying to think of a place that we would get to. I'm thinking of Newark, for example, or further away where there's a little bit more to it. That being said, it's really the right answers to have as little steps as possible. I mean, the romaine that we're referring to came from Southern California, but we get romaine from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
It is so crazy that we do that, given how much easier it's becoming to grow locally every day.
Right. Well, yeah. And what I was going to say is, you know, that technology is the transparency timeline is such a seems like such an incredible tool. Like, is it technology that you would potentially that other companies could use in agriculture, or do you think that overall other technologies like this will be applied to farming around the world?
I think the industrial food system really tries to avoid the subject.
Mm.
So I don't think they're going to embrace a transparency timeline, because it would scare the daylights out of you if you saw it.
Right.
So I think really it's about the next generation of farming, indoor farming, farmers that are embracing the future, where they really do want the consumer to know how long ago it was harvested. But if you're in the industrial food system, this is not information you want to share.
Yeah.
The industrial food system is, you know, thrives on the lack of transparency, because if you actually knew what was going on, you wouldn't want the food.
Right. And the timeline would be so long, you would be like reading a novel.
Like, oh my goodness, it would be crazy. If they could even do it. I mean, if they could practically even do it, it would be a crazy long timeline.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, and you know, so this is, I mean, the transparency timeline is an example of just like very straightforward application of technology that I think no one could argue is like it's giving consumers information, it's keeping track of where the food is. And I think, you know, what's interesting to me is you're someone who kind of straddles these two worlds, you know, of tech and food. And it can be more like, that's a really clear example, but it can be a pretty sticky space. And I think a lot of the technologies that exist are, people don't agree on whether they're good or bad for the environment, for human health. And I'm just curious, like from a big picture perspective, what do you see as technology's role in building a more sustainable food system? And I guess even more importantly, how do we distinguish between good and bad technologies while continuing to innovate?
Yeah, I think if we focus on the goal, which is real food that we trust,
mm-hmm.
I think technology can be used really powerfully. I think the when you remove the farmer from the equation, or you remove transparency from the equation, I think that's when technology becomes way less interesting.
Mm.
The if we end up with food that doesn't really taste very good, or technology that enables us to ship food for longer, that doesn't rock my world. But if it's technology that makes the food taste better, and enabled us to use less pesticides. You know, indoor farming uses almost nothing, but ideally we do want to use absolutely nothing. And all of these technology improvements do enable us to create food that tastes better and we trust more. And I think that's when I get really excited about technology.
Mm. When you say tastes better, what do you mean by that?
I mean, the basil that we grow in New York, it just tastes much better than any other basil out there. And it's grown with a very, very a beautiful climate that we know creates a delicious basil out there. But it is also not shipped, so it doesn't have any basil will have a lot of spotting when it comes in from far away. Mm-hmm. We just don't have any of that. It is beautifully clean, delicious basil. And when you take it home, it'll last another 5 or 10 days in your home. So it just tastes better because it's fresh. And it's also grown in a climate-controlled environment where it is absolutely the most delicious basil you've ever had.
Right. I mean, it's interesting that you can sort of get the perfect conditions in that closed environment.
like
a lot of farmers are probably...
The climate control is so powerful. It really is amazing where you can grow the same basil over and over again and make it, you know, obviously refine it each time to make it a little bit better. But it is, you don't have all of the force majeure of nature. So
right.
You've replicated nature, but it's absolutely perfect every time.
Right. Well, so the flip side of that is a lot of people would argue that like you know, maybe you're stripping something out because you don't have sort of the fluctuations of nature. And I think like the best example of that argument is soil, right? So there's some people don't like the idea of growing without soil. Others are super passionate about hydroponics. And you know, I guess in my mind, like the taste question isn't, I mean, I think taste is really important because people will eat things that taste good and we need them to eat healthy things and things that are good for the planet. But I'm more interested in soil in terms of, you know, its ability to sequester carbon. And everyone sort of agrees soil is depleted, right, all over the world, and that
right.
It's really hard to grow in. But there's like this idea that we should be regenerating the soil so that it can sequester carbon. And then there's systems like Square Roots that are saying like, well, if the soil is depleted, we'll just grow inside. But I'm curious what you think, like what's the role of soil to you in building a more sustainable food system? Is it what we need to do both or is it, you know,
I think it really is about doing both. We're not at all anti-soil. Our restaurants, we source almost 100% from soil-based farmers.
Mm.
We love working with them. What we don't like to do is have it shipped in from around the world because in January, on a snowy day in Boulder in February, we have to do that.
Yeah.
We would much prefer to have Square Roots, you know, locally, and we would have locally grown greens that taste great every time. The soil farmers really do play a wonderful role. I'd like the land to be used for more nutritious foods. Most of our soil-based farming is corn and soybean.
Right.
And it's not good for the environment. It's certainly not good for people because it's really just it's a meat. It's for animals, animal feed. And ethanol, 40% of our corn-based land, which I think is 25 million acres of land, twice the size of the California Central Valley, is used to grow ethanol.
Oh my God!
Which at its best is a neutral. In other words, you take 1 gallon of oil to create 1 gallon of ethanol.
Right.
So, most of our farming and soil has really, really been terrible for the environment.
Mm-hmm.
If we move things more towards growing fresh food locally, it'll do more carbon sequestering. It'll grow food that is better for you. That I love, and we're huge supporters of that. In addition to that. Urban farming is going to play a great role because 11 months out of the year, we really do have a superior product.
Mm-hmm.
For that 1 month in June when basil truly is perfect coming out of the soil, I actually think it's truly is great. It's great to have a local farmer
mm-hmm.
give you basil from soil. But for the other 11 months, it really is better indoors.
Right. And so right now, Square Roots is just in Brooklyn. Is that right?
It's just in Brooklyn.
Yeah. So tell me, what's the future? Like, what will this look like 10 years from now?
Yeah, we're working hard on that to grow our what we call campuses. So what you visited was a normal campus. We're working on different parts around the country where we will service communities, and we'll have exciting developments to announce over the next few months. But our goal is really to bring real food to everyone. So we want to start at premium products, and as the technology matures, start moving into more salad-oriented greens. But eventually, we'll go all the way to blooming vegetables like strawberries and peppers, eggplant, really whatever we think will resonate with the consumer and works with the technology.
Mm. Are there particular locations that this model works better in? Like a reason you started in New York City, and as you expand, like, are you looking at particular kinds of cities?
Well, we'd love New York City because that's a city where demand is just not the issue. So if you have a good product, there's plenty of demand. And so we like that, and that was a good way to test out the technology platform. And as we get it to, you know, the quality and price that makes sense for our customer, we'll be able to sort of really analyze, you know, what are the next communities we should be going into.
Okay. How about Boulder?
I'd love to do one in Boulder. Probably not too far away.
Yeah. Well, I was surprised that you didn't start there since, you know, your restaurant is there and everything. But I guess New York just, like you said, the demand is so high, right? There's just so many of us
here.
It's
a great place to do it. And people from around the country are flocking to join Square Roots as a farmer or as an engineer. And New York is just one of those places where it's a great place to attract talent.
Right. All right. Well, I think we need to wrap up. Thank you so much, Kimball, for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate, and share it. I'll see you next Wednesday when we'll be talking about hemp.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. You can connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.